Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, April 7, 2014. There's a killer on the loose. You can find him at the White House. And the federal courts say the president has supreme power to order the drone strike that can kill an American citizen. Now, I recognize that some people are offended by strong, blunt language. Calling the President of the United States a killer or an assassin? I know it makes people uncomfortable. And some people recoil and say, Peter, how could you do that? It's Barack Obama, the hope and change guy. But here we have what appears to be the last step in an effort to require the president to observe the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. Most people think Fifth Amendment, that's self-incrimination, right? Well, it also requires that your life or liberty cannot be deprived without due process. And that's what is at issue here, and my friends at the Center for Constitutional Rights have brought a case on behalf of the survivors of Anwar al-Awlaki. His father and mother, a grandfather, and the mother of Samir Khan, another American who was killed by a drone strike in Yemen with the senior Awlaki. He was never indicted. There was never a warrant issued for his arrest or his execution. And now a federal judge, who had previously made noises about how troubled she was by this case, has ruled in favor of the government, saying that because we are in a stage of war, and I want to address that in a moment, that individual officials cannot be held accountable for money damages for taking the life of an American citizen without due process. And what is interesting is that recently, Judge Rosemary Collyer was appointed to the FISA court by Chief Justice John Roberts. Did that change her tune, or was it a way of making sure that she stayed on the program, stayed on message, on script? I don't know. But what really bothers me is, here's a quote from the decision by Judge Collyer, a 41-page opinion. The persons holding the jobs of the named defendants must be trusted and expected to act in accordance with the U.S. Constitution when they intentionally target a U.S. citizen abroad at the direction of the president and with the concurrence of Congress. They cannot be held personally responsible in monetary damages for conducting war. Now, the war that she talks about has never been approved by Congress. There's no authority for the president to conduct drone strikes in Yemen made by the Congress of the United States. We are not at war with Yemen. We are conducting what we say are covert operations in Yemen. And it's on a really flimsy basis because they invoke the blank check that Bush got after 9/11, the authorization for use of military force, and say that because they believe Al-Qaeda attacked us on 9/11, that we can go after Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, a group that did not exist on September 11th of 2001. It's creepy, and it's mission creep. Over at the Center for Constitutional Rights, Bahar Azmi, the legal director, issued this statement: the Constitution cannot permit the killing of U.S. citizens based on the government's untested claim of dangerousness. And the judge cited a series of unproven claims. Official statements that Awlaki was a terrorist leader. She cited an account of his role in the plot to blow up that Detroit-bound airliner with the underwear bomber on Christmas Day of 2009. Those are based on court documents of the guy who pleaded guilty, meaning that his conviction was not tested in court. There was no cross-examination. There was no examination of the evidence in that case. And so for the judge to cite this unproven information, a series of allegations from our government, is really offensive. And it really underscores what Jonathan Turley, the distinguished law professor from George Washington University, recently said about Obama. That he has successfully expanded presidential power beyond any president before him. And because he's a Democrat, the Democrats who opposed it when Bush grabbed power have acquiesced. Republicans lick their chops, imagining when the next Republican gets to run the White House and these expansive presidential powers. It's really scary. And it gets reported on where the New York Times buried this on page A10. I think it should be a screaming headline story on the front page. Meanwhile, on the front page of Sunday's Times, a story about the stalled effort related to the drone program to move it away from the CIA and concentrate control of it at the Pentagon. Mark Mazzetti does a good job of explaining that despite the fact that John Brennan, a year ago when he was confirmed as CIA director, and he has a 25-year history with the agency, he said he wanted to change it. He said that the CIA should not be doing traditional military activities and operations. He wants them to do traditional spying and intelligence gathering operations. At least that's what he said. But the Central Intelligence Agency's drone war in Yemen continues. In Pakistan, the CIA remains in charge of drone operations. In Jordan, it's the CIA rather than the Pentagon that's running the program to arm and train the Syrian rebels. That's a concession to the Jordanian government. And in addition to Brennan's call for this change, the president essentially issued an order announcing new procedures for drone operations last May in a speech that he gave in Washington. None of this has happened. And, you know, to me, it makes a minor difference. I think our drone program is something that we have relied way too much on. I don't think that we should never use drones. But this kind of remote control warfare has sharp limits. It's limited to the value of the intelligence we collect on the targets and whether or not we get the right people. And we know that thousands of innocent people have been killed by Hellfire missiles fired from American drones. And the irony here is that Senator Feinstein, who chairs the Intelligence Committee, who is currently duking it out with John Brennan over the torture report that we'll get to in a moment, she does not support Brennan's call or Obama's order to take the CIA out of the drone striking business. And so the drones continue to fly, although it's fair to say that there has not been a reported strike in Pakistan since last Christmas of 2013. But they continue to fly reconnaissance missions. And, of course, there may be strikes that we are not told about. Here at the Peter B. Collins Show, there are individuals all over the country and, frankly, in other nations as well who support my work with their subscriptions. Rex Wetzel out there in Wolcottville, Indiana, just renewed his subscription for another year. Thank you, Rex. Paul Elsesser sends a check the first of every month, a staunch supporter of this program. And Ray Bixler in Chicago sent a check, but no email address so that I can set him up with a subscription. So, Ray, if you hear me talking about you, would you email Peter at peterbcollins.com so I can take care of that for you? I'd like to. And I'd like you to sign up. I'm talking to you with the earbuds listening to me right now, wherever you are. If you haven't taken out a subscription, I hope you'll consider doing it. You can decide $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. The best deal is our $50 annual subscription, and our current bonus gift is the Rockin' CD by John Dist called Red Flag, plus your bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. So get on board today. I really need your support. That's how this whole thing works, and I don't get corporate commercials. We have this little deal with Audible.com where I get $15 if you take out one of their trial subscriptions, a one-month trial, but you have to do it through my website, following the link either in the show file of this podcast or the banner ad that's on the left-hand side of the pages at my website. All you got to do is click through on that, sign up for their one-month trial. You can cancel it at any time in 30 days and not have to pay a dime. But it will cause them to send me a check for $15. I hope you'll support us every way we can. The latest from Glenn Greenwald, based on Ed Snowden documents, reveals a program run by the British intelligence agency GCHQ called Royal Concierge. That's where the British agency intercepts email confirmations of hotel reservations to enable it to subject hotel guests to electronic monitoring. It also contemplates how to influence the hotel choice of travelers and to determine whether they stay in what are called SIGINT-friendly hotels. Those are wired hotels. And the document asks, can we influence the hotel choice? Can we cancel a hotel reservation? Der Spiegel and NBC News have independently confirmed that the Royal Concierge program has been implemented and extensively used. Der Spiegel said that for more than 3 years, GCHQ has had a system to automatically monitor hotel bookings of at least 350 upscale hotels around the world. Isn't that special? The concierge. And Greenwald started off by talking about our secret Twitter copy program in Cuba. And he closes his column by saying, these programs, carried out in secrecy and with little accountability, it seems that nobody in Congress knew of the Cuban Twitter program in any detail, threaten the integrity of the Internet itself, as state-disseminated propaganda masquerades as free online speech and organizing. There is thus little or no ability for an Internet user to know when they're being covertly propagandized by their government. And Amnesty International over the weekend held a conference in Chicago, and they wheeled in Glenn Greenwald by video from Brazil and Ed Snowden by video link from Moscow. Raving applause for both, a standing O for Snowden. And Greenwald promises that he's going to cover over the next 60 days some of the abuses that have come from the technology that's already been exposed, like Mystic and some of the other programs, Prism. He warns that the metadata collection has much more import than so far the information might lead us to believe. So we'll continue to watch for that. Over the weekend, I posted an in-depth interview with Gareth Porter. It's the audio from a live television broadcast we did here originating from Marin County, California, last Thursday evening. Gareth Porter is a longtime historian and journalist. His new book is called Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And in this excerpt, Gareth Porter comments on the current negotiations with Iran and Israel's determination to scuttle them in any way possible.
Well, there's no question. The Israelis want the talks to fail. I mean, they've hardly made any secret of that. It's really quite transparent in the public position taken by Netanyahu himself, as well as other senior Israeli officials, that they really don't want any deal that wouldn't completely end the capability of Iran to do enrichment. I mean, that they would accept a deal that would essentially end the nuclear program, but that's the only deal that they would find acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So virtually everything that they've tried to do over the past few years in terms of their insistence to the Obama administration about the U.S. Diplomatic posture in those talks has been aimed essentially at sabotaging them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole series of things that the Israelis have insisted on that were clearly aimed at that. And you've named one of them, which was the idea that that Iran should be prevented from basically having their missile program. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the implication of the language that has been put forward. I don't think that that's really a serious proposal. I don't think the United States expects that there is, in fact, going to be any agreement that deals with the Iranian missile program.
You can hear the full interview with Gareth Porter. It's up for subscribers right now at peterbcollins.com. Well, George W. Bush is getting some of the most warm and fuzzy reporting we've seen since he left the White House. And it's because he's taken up brush and oil and become a painter. And he's above average in his painting skills, I'll grant you that. And it's a real surprise to see a guy like him have any kind of an expressionist side. And it's funny because the place where his work is being debuted is at his own presidential library at Southern Methodist outside Dallas. I don't imagine that there are galleries around the world saying, "Hey, W, can we sell your paintings?" And the latest batch are paintings of his buddies, world leaders that he encountered during his eight years in the White House? Anyway, Bush himself seems slightly modest about this. He joked that he has a Rembrandt trapped in his body. He acknowledges that the signature is worth more than the painting because of who he is, and told a recent gathering that it was either confident or foolish of him to put his work on display. Now, he submitted to a grueling interview Friday. I didn't watch it. It was on the Today Show. And the grueling interview about his painting was conducted by his daughter, Jenna. And that's how the media bends over backwards. To fawn over this former president who presided over the darkest era in recent American history, unless, of course, Obama wins that title. It's kind of a draw at this point. But I found it highly ironic. In Saturday's San Francisco Chronicle, there's a story about Bush the painter and pictures of some of his paintings. And turning a single page, I get to the editorial page where the lead editorial screams, "Release the torture report." And, you know, as far as the editorial goes, I agree with their position. But what it doesn't demand is any accountability once that torture report is released. I mean, you know, it's not enough for Bush to paint a picture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed being waterboarded. And I don't know if you feel that this irony is lost on too many people. But I'm really aggrieved that the editorial writers at major papers will pose as, you know, offended by the torture history that occurred. But they accept the obstruction of justice. We're going to review all this so it doesn't happen again, but not a single person will be prosecuted for it. That's really offensive. No one would argue that we should give a pass to other obvious crimes. We have a judge absolving Obama of any liability for ordering the deaths of Americans with a drone strike in a foreign country. And we don't demand that anyone, including Bush or Cheney, face any consequences for what they did. And I can't, this is a blog post that I've seen online. It appears to be accurate, but I just want to offer the caveat that I haven't seen an official announcement to this effect. But it says the CIA itself gets to choose which parts of the torture report remain secret, and indicates that the Obama White House, which had a choice of declassifying this 6,000-page report and its 480-page executive summary at the White House, or allowing the CIA to do it. And what that means is that the parts of the report that are critical of the CIA, that showed that the law was broken even after the law had been relaxed by the John U.J. Bybee memos, that will be the stuff that is blacked out if and when this report is ever published. And it's like the CIA cornered Obama and said, look, you let the FBI investigate its own wrongdoing in the Todashev case. In 151 out of 151 cases, the FBI has investigated itself and established that the killings or shootings were justified. And CIA wants to live by the same rules as FBI. That's my speculation, but I think it's a worthwhile comparison. On the Sunday TV political shows that I never watch, Nancy Pelosi was interviewed yesterday, and she points the finger over torture at Dick Cheney. On CNN, she said, I do believe that during the Bush-Cheney administration, the Vice President Cheney set a tone and attitude for the CIA. Many people in the CIA are so patriotic. They protect our country in a way to avoid conflict and violence. But the attitude that was there was very, I think it came from Dick Cheney. That's what I believe. I think he's proud of it. Now, Pelosi's not inaccurate about this, but she shares her own responsibility. She was briefed into the torture programs. They may have lied to her. They may have minimized what was going on. But she knew far more than you and I did. And despite that, when she became the speaker after the 2006 election, she held to a stupid campaign commitment not to impeach Bush or Cheney. And at the time, many of us thought they should start by impeaching Cheney, because impeaching Bush only to be replaced by Cheney wouldn't help things. And a double header would be very difficult for the Senate to accommodate. And Nancy Pelosi took impeachment off the table, despite what she knew. And I've known Nancy since she went to Congress in the late 80s. I've disclosed to you before that I worked for her on her campaign in 1996. Personally, I like her a great deal, and I have a lot of respect for the way she has risen to the leadership of her party. But I've lost a lot of respect because of her failure to allow impeachment. John Conyers would have handled it. It's not like she had to personally roll up her sleeves and do it. And she's been far too accommodating of President Obama's expansion of presidential power, as we described at the beginning of today's podcast. In this corner, we have a man accused of intolerance because he donated $1,000 to Proposition 8 here in California, which would attempted to take away the right of same-sex couples to marry, which had been granted by our state Supreme Court. And in this other corner, we have intolerant supporters of marriage equality who say that because Brendan Eich, one of the founders of Mozilla, the maker of the Firefox browser, also the original architect of JavaScript, that he could not continue as CEO of Mozilla because 5 years ago he donated $1,000 in support of Proposition 8. I don't know Brendan Eich. I honestly don't know if he's a religious person. or just a traditionalist. But as full-throated as I deplore the intention of Proposition 8, I will raise my voice to the same level to defend the right of an individual like Brendan Eich to have his opinion and to spend $1,000 to promote it. I'll tell you a quick story. In 1968, Hubert Humphrey was running for president, and my dad, who was an activist in the Democratic Party in the Republican stronghold of Cincinnati, Ohio, attended a fundraiser, and I was actually there. I got to meet Hubert Humphrey. It was kind of cool. But my dad donated $1,000 to the Humphrey for President campaign. The next morning, it was on the front page of the Cincinnati Enquirer, listing him with two other people as if they are the idiots of the city because they not only supported a Democrat for president, but they gave him a campaign contribution. And because I am on the unpopular side of many arguments that are alive in America today, I can't for a moment condone the actions of mostly gay activists who built a little shitstorm around Brendan Eich last week. And he has stepped down. I think that's a violation of his First Amendment rights. I think he's wrong on the principle, but that's just my opinion. And these activists should be ashamed of themselves for being so narrow-minded and intolerant that they would start a boycott of a frickin' web browser because the guy who just was promoted to run the company used his free speech rights. I have to say, in expressing this, I'm a little bit queasy because I heard Rush Limbaugh ranting on the same issue on Friday. And he goes in wacky and different directions. It's not like we fully agree. But on this one, I speak up for tolerance. Very interesting reporting following up the latest mass shooting at Fort Hood, Texas. And while the military's tried to play down that the shooter was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or mental illness, he clearly, things went beyond just the fact that he was pissed off because somebody wouldn't grant him leave. Combat veterans are responsible for almost 21% of domestic violence nationwide. This is comparable to the fact that veterans alone account for 20% of U.S. suicides, and the suicide rate of veterans is at an all-time high. I think it's 2 years in a row now that more uniformed service members have killed themselves than been killed in combat. And even as the overall frequency of domestic abuse in the United States declined, levels of intimate partner violence within the post-9/11 military and veterans communities have exploded. Calls from people affiliated with the military more than tripled from 2006 to 2011. During that time period at Fort Carson near Colorado Springs, the number of stationed soldiers charged with domestic violence surged. We got a real problem on our hands. And I am not trying to jump to a conclusion about the latest Fort Hood shooter and his motivation. But we're in denial about the mental health of America's service members. Owners of at least 24 nuclear power plants across the United States have told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that they cannot show that their reactors would withstand the most severe earthquake, like the one that hit Fukushima, Japan. As a result, the reactor's owners will be required to undertake extensive analysis of their structures and components. Could cost as much as $5 million for each nuclear facility. And this is a welcome development, in my view. I'd like them to start with Diablo Canyon, the twin reactor facility near San Luis Obispo on the Pacific coast of California that was built within like half a mile or less of the Hosgree Fault. I'd like to see them decommission that sucker as fast as humanly possible. Finally today, a little scorecard published over the weekend by the New York Times shows that the threat of Tea Party right-wing super extremists knocking off established so-called Republican conservatives is kind of evaporating. In Texas, John Cornyn faced a right-wing nut, even more nutty than John Cornyn, and that's saying something. He won the nomination. There is one farther right opponent to Idaho Senator Jim Risch in the May 20th primary. Mitch McConnell has a Tea Party challenger in the May 20 primary in Kentucky. Jeff Sessions has no opponent in Alabama, June 3rd primary. Same for Mississippi's Thad Cochran. In both cases, there were people threatening to challenge them. In Maine, Susan Collins, Tea Party opponent, has withdrawn. Lindsey Graham, though, has six opponents. In South Carolina, that's a June 10 primary. In Oklahoma, James Inhofe. How can anybody find an inch to get to his right? He has no opposition so far. One opponent for Pat Roberts in Kansas. Lamar Alexander has eight opponents in Tennessee, with the primary way out in August 7th. And in Wyoming, Dick Cheney's little girl Liz withdrew her challenge to sitting Senator Mike Enzi. So Tennessee is still a place where, and also South Carolina, where these extreme Republicans could take out what passes for a more moderate Republican. I mean, Lamar Alexander, certainly more moderate than Lindsey Graham. But of course, when you get six or eight challengers in a race, the incumbent has a huge advantage at getting to a mere 25 or 30% in order to defeat the pack. So, that's the latest from here. I want to thank you for listening today. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.